Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
I'll go ahead and start. My name is Emily Calandrelli. On the interwebs, I am known as the Space Gal. I am an MIT engineer turned science TV show host. So today I am the executive producer and host of Exploration Outer Space on Fox. It's a Saturday morning science show where I just travel all over the country and talk to scientists and engineers about rockets and spaceships and aliens and rovers on Mars and everything in between. I also work with Bill Nye. So I am a correspondent on his show on Netflix called Bill Nye Saves the World. And as someone who grew up watching Bill Nye in the classroom, it is, as you can imagine, a dream of mine to be able to work with him on his new TV show. And so for that job, I get to travel the world and cover different science stories for Bill. And so last year I went to India and I got to cover a story about space exploration. They have a small team in India that is building a rover to go to the moon. And it would be the very first private company to land on the moon if they're successful. And it would be the very first entity from India to soft land on the moon. And I say soft land because there have been probes that have hard landed on the moon, aka crashed. So soft landing is very different. It's much more difficult. And of course, what we were just talking about, my most recent job is as the author of the Ada Lace Adventures. And so if you're unfamiliar, Ada Lace is a third grader scientist inventor extraordinaire who loves building robots and gadgets to solve mysteries in her life. It's kind of like Nancy Drew, but with robots and microscopes. And it's a really, really fun story. So I'm from West Virginia, and the girl in the book is from West Virginia. She moves to San Francisco with her family. I'm from West Virginia. I moved to San Francisco. And so it's all about her adventures in this new city, new town, making new friends, and solving mysteries in her own backyard with science and technology. And because I am an MIT engineer by training, all of the science and tech in the books are real, right? They're based on real science. That was very important to me to make sure that the science and tech in there was very accurate. And so there's a lot of research that goes into the book to make sure that the stuff that we talk about is in fact true. And one of my favorite parts, and you probably have already seen that in that book, at the very end of the book, there's something called Behind the Science. Because as you read the book, there will be various science things talked about throughout the story. But if you want to learn more about any part of those science things, there is kind of like a science glossary in the back that just goes more into what the science is and then gives the kids who read it resources outside of the book to learn more about it. So for example, one of the books we talk about Arduino boards, which is a really common technology that people can use to build different types of electronics projects. And so we casually mentioned that Ada uses this Arduino board and we talk a little bit about how it works, but then in the back of the book, you learn more about it and where to find one if you actually want to build one yourself. So it's an interactive book, I think. And we're really excited that the third book comes out next week. But one of my main jobs that I want to talk to you about today is as the host of Exploration Outer Space. I get to have a lot of adventures in the science world. And so I've gotten to do everything from, you know, go to space camp. I never went to space camp as a kid, so I got to go to space camp finally as an adult. I went to Hawaii recently to go see the most famous telescopes on top of a volcano. And so they put these observatories, these telescopes on these peaks of mountains and volcanoes for a very important reason. Does anyone here know why they put telescopes on top of very, very tall peaks? Yeah?
To avoid the cloudiness.
Exactly. Right. To get above as much atmosphere as you can. Because have you ever seen a star twinkle? Have you ever seen like stars twinkling in the night sky? Well, that twinkling only happens because the light from the star is bouncing off the molecules in our atmosphere. So that twinkling you see is really pretty for us, but for astronomers, it's the worst thing ever because they're trying to get a crisp, clear picture of that star, and they don't want the atmosphere. They don't want that twinkling effect because they want to know exactly what that star looks like. And so for observatories and telescopes where they're trying to take pictures of the night sky, they put them on the tops of really tall peaks of mountains. And so when you go see observatories, like maybe the Griffith Observatory in LA, they have the Lick Observatory in south of San Francisco, you have to go up a windy mountain all the way to the top to get as above as much of the atmosphere as you can. And so some of the most famous observatories are in Hawaii on top of volcanoes. And so I got to do that last year. One really fun place, I'd never been here before, I went to Alaska last year, and we launched what's known as a high altitude balloon, which is basically a weather balloon and something that's just like this huge helium balloon that you launch up into the atmosphere. And scientists use high altitude balloons to launch experiments into the atmosphere. Balloons can't go into space, but you can go pretty far up, like 100,000 feet, which is about three times higher than a commercial airline flies. So it's really, really high, and it's a cool way to launch experiments up into the atmosphere. But we went to Alaska to do it because we wanted to study one very specific thing. Does anyone want to guess what we were studying in Alaska? What happens in Alaska that we'd maybe not see a little bit south down here? The Aurora Borealis, exactly. And so the team that we went with wanted to launch an experiment up into the aurora to understand the interactions between the molecules in the atmosphere to see what was happening. Because the reason why the Northern Lights happens, and it happens, the aurora happens in the north and in the south of the world. In the south, it's called the Aurora Australis, so the Southern Lights. Right? We only think of them as Northern Lights because more people live in the north part of our world, so more people see it up north. But the reason why the Northern Lights happens is because our sun is such an active body that it's constantly spewing high energetic particles to our world, to our Earth, but we have this really cool thing that's the magnetic field around the Earth. And the magnetic field kind of siphons all of that energy to the north and the south poles, and that energy excites the molecules in our atmosphere and causes them to light up. And so we get to see these different beautiful colors in the atmosphere based on the molecules in our atmosphere. That determines the color of the aurora. So you'll see a lot of like blues and greens from the oxygen in our atmosphere. The nitrogen will add a little bit of a different color. So depending on the composition of the atmosphere, you see different colors in the Northern Lights, which is really fun. So we did an experiment there. One thing that was fun that I did a couple years ago is I got to go to Harry Potter World with an astronaut. And I love space, but I really, really love Harry Potter. And so this was one of the most fun adventures I'd had recently. And you might be asking, you know, for a space show, a TV show about space, why would you go to Harry Potter World, right? Well, I went with an astronaut to ride all of the roller coaster rides. And so we got to, basically, he wanted to show me how riding a roller coaster, where if you've ever ridden a roller coaster, you feel it. Like if you go really, really fast, you get pushed back in your seat. Or if you go around a sharp turn, you get pulled over to the side this way or pulled over to the side that way. Those are called G-forces. You get gravitational forces. G stands for gravitational forces on your body. And you actually, it seems kind of wild, but you get the same G-forces by riding in a roller coaster that an astronaut feels when launching into space on a rocket. You feel the exact, theirs is for a more prolonged period of time, but you get to feel that same force. So we got to go to Harry Potter World before the park even opened. The sun hadn't even risen yet, and we had the park all to ourselves. And so that's one of my favorite memories, is just riding all of these roller coasters in Harry Potter World with an astronaut who's explaining to me what it feels like to launch into space. That was really fun. And then I think this is the coolest thing I have done in my whole life. So this is something I've done a couple of times now, and it is something called the Vomit Comet. Now, raise your hand if you've heard of the Vomit Comet before. Okay, have you? No? Oh my gosh, I'm so excited to tell you. This is the coolest thing I've ever done in my whole life. So the Vomit Comet is a plane that flies like a roller coaster. It's basically like an 8,000-foot roller coaster in the sky. And the reason why they do it is because when people who are inside of it, when they're inside of it, when you go over the hump, you're free falling inside the plane. You're basically floating like an astronaut inside the plane. This is how they filmed a lot of different space movies. Like Apollo 13, they filmed a lot of their floating activities inside this Vomit Comet airplane. But you only get weightless for about 30 seconds. So you can imagine filming a long movie in just 30-second intervals. It takes a while. But then the plane has to go back down and come back up, right? So when it goes like this under the hump and it starts to dive back up again, that's when you feel really, really heavy. You feel about twice your weight. It's a bit uncomfortable. People inside the plane, you have to lay flat so that your body doesn't get disoriented. And so you have these periods of being weightless and then really, really heavy and then weightless and heavy and weightless and heavy and weightless and heavy for an hour and a half, which is why they call it the Vomit Comet. Right? Because if you had to ride something that intense for an hour and a half, you might get sick. And so there was one thing we did for our show recently. I'll actually get to that. Let me see. Let's do that now. So just to rewind a little bit, the Vomit Comet is a really cool experience that you can actually do as a student if you want to study science and engineering. And so if you can fly on it two ways. You can either buy a ticket on the Vomit Comet, or you are a student or a researcher studying science and engineering, and you want to develop a research experiment to fly on the Vomit Comet. Because as you can imagine, it's a really fun ride to ride, but scientists use this as a laboratory to better understand how things react differently in a weightless environment. And so the first time I got to ride the Vomit Comet was through a student experiment. Because if you want to buy a ticket on it just for fun, it costs $6,000. It's a really expensive joyride. But if you want to do it for free, which is how I did it, I studied science and engineering in college, and I took a class where me and a team of people, it was like me and seven friends, designed an experiment that got accepted by NASA, and NASA let us ride on the Vomit Comet for free, which is pretty cool. And so the reason that I got into aerospace engineering was, A, I really liked math, and I was a very logical high school student, and I looked up the careers that used math and looked up the majors and saw, I ranked them by how much money each major made after they graduated from college. And so I was a very logical high school senior. I was like, okay, across the board, engineers, on average, make a lot of money when they graduate from college. I'm going to do engineering. And I remember as a freshman in college walking down the hallways, because when you're a freshman, you have to decide what kind of engineering. You can't just do engineering. There's civil engineering, electrical engineering, computer engineering, mechanical, aerospace. There's a lot of different kinds. And I remember seeing a poster on the wall that said something like, do your homework weightless. And I was like, what kind of weird metaphor is that? And it turns out it was a class that you could take if you wanted to be an aerospace engineer and you could fly on the Vomit Comet. So the reason I chose to go into aerospace engineering was because I wanted to fly on the Vomit Comet. And it changed my life. It made me obsessed with this world of aerospace and the research that these people do, because it's so fascinating thinking of how different the world can be in space, researching how things are different in a weightless environment. It was so interesting to me. And so now that I have my TV show and I have this wonderful platform, I wanted to share that experience with others. And so I created this specific episode. It's a special episode that we do every year called the Student Astronaut Contest. And what it is it's basically a nationwide contest where we go on a search for one very special STEM student to give them an experience of a lifetime that will help launch their career in the aerospace industry. And a couple years ago, the prize that we gave was a free ride on the Vomit Comet. And so we had all these people from different universities all over the country apply. And part of the application process was you had to figure out an experiment to do in weightlessness. You had to propose, what would you want to try out in weightlessness? What would you like to see how it's different in a weightless environment? And I think I have a little bit of a video here that shows what happened with that show. So I think this is probably, I'm not sure exactly what video this is. I think this is going to be a 2-minute summary of what that episode ended up being. And so you can see us actually have some fun in the vomit comment.
Welcome to our Exploration Station Facebook page for your chance to take the wildest ride of your life. The way that you came from that room and talked about how dancers don't often think about how gravity affects the different moves that they do.
That was so interesting. I wanted to dance in microgravity with
you. Yes, that'd be great.
Dancing in zero G would make for a fascinating experiment, which is what he proposed in his video application.
How many times did I spin before I stopped when there's nothing to stop me?
Another dance move we need to try is the pirouette. On land, Sam's pirouette was smooth and effortless. Let's see how he does up here. Effortless, but not so smooth. Now it's my turn. Obviously not a professional dancer.
Wow!
Maybe if we hold hands, we can have more control. Not quite. Here's another experiment, jumping through a hula hoop. Now that I've seen Sam's attempt, it's my turn. If you're going to have a once-in-a-lifetime experience, you might as well have some fun. 25 parabolas later,
we did it!
Oh, that was awesome!
We come back to solid ground.
So you heard he said 25 parabolas. That's one of each of these. So you have one period of weightlessness, one period of being really heavy. That's one parabola. So we did it 25 times, which, after you do that long, it's so much fun, but at the end of that, you're ready to get off the ride because it is a little bit disorienting. So when you ride on the Vomit Comet, you wear this very special flight suit, and in that flight suit, you have a pocket right here, and in that pocket, you bring the most important tool that you will bring on that plane. What do you think that tool is? A barf bag. It is a barf bag, because if you throw up when you're weightless, where does that throw up go? Everywhere, right? So you have to be very, very careful with that. And if you get sick, which I did, you have to throw up in a bag and tie it up and hand it off to one of the workers that works on the plane, which sounds like the worst job ever. But not just barf acts differently in a weightless environment, right? Everything works differently in space, which is why this is such an important laboratory to use to study all of these different things. So this is something I think is really, really cool. The shape of a flame on Earth, if you've ever seen a candle or seen a lighter or whatever it is, makes like a pretty long teardrop shape, right? Well, the only reason it looks like that is because we have gravity. Because hot air, which is lighter than regular air, rises and it elongates that flame to be a little bit long like this. It looks like a teardrop. That's the same way hot air balloons work, right? They heat up the air, it becomes lighter than regular air, and it forces that hot air balloon to rise. So that's the only reason we have that teardrop shape under Earth's gravity. But when you see a flame in space, which is a very important thing to study, right? Because think about the laboratories we have in space. If there was a fire there, that's a contained space with a lot of oxygen. It can be really dangerous. And so one of the most important research that NASA does is understanding how fire propagates, how fire moves and grows in a weightless environment. And so a flame in microgravity, because hot air doesn't rise because you don't have that difference in gravity, it just goes out like a sphere. It goes out in every direction. So it looks really, really cool, I think. So another thing that's important that changes in a weightless environment is how astronauts work out. Because you may have heard this, you know, when you're floating weightless in space, it looks really fun. But in actuality, it's really dangerous for an astronaut's body because you don't have that benefit of gravity where you have, you know, a lot of pressure or a lot of force on your bones and on your muscles. You're not using your muscles and bones as much as you would here on Earth. And so astronauts, when they spend too much time in space, they have bone loss, they have muscle loss, and it's actually can be really dangerous. They're really weak when they come back home. But one of the ways that you can make that less bad is by working out in space. So astronauts work out 2 hours a day in space. But if you imagine how difficult it is for an aerospace engineer or a mechanical engineer to design workout equipment in a weightless environment, because if you pick up a dumbbell that's really heavy, you could pick up the heaviest dumbbell in the world. You'd be the most strong person in the universe, right? And you could let that dumbbell go and it would just float. It doesn't weigh anything because you don't have gravity. It has mass, but it doesn't have a weight, right? And so you have to think of new ways to work out. And one of the ways they do this is with this astronaut treadmill. Because think of any type of exercise you do. When you run, every step you're taking, you're leaping up from the floor, but you have gravity that brings you back down. But if you didn't have gravity, if you did that in a weightless environment, you would just pop up off the floor and hit your head on the ceiling, right? So they had to create this new treadmill where it's basically like bungee cords on either side of your shoulders because it's like basically a rubber band. When you stretch a rubber band and let one side go, what happens? It wants to go back to its original shape, right? So in this way, they're creating artificial gravity or fake gravity. So every time they take a step, the bungee cord stretches and it forces them back down to the treadmill, which is really neat. And here, usually I like to talk about, do you play sports? Yeah? What kind of sports do you play?
I play soccer.
You play soccer. Very cool. Okay. So I want you to think about how soccer would be different if you played it in space, right? So in space, there's two things to consider. Weightless, you're weightless in one. And if you actually played it in the vacuum of space, you wouldn't have air. Do you ever do a spin move in soccer? Do you guys do those?
Not yet.
Okay. But some soccer players I've seen, like really professional, like they can be in the corner pocket and the goal will be right here and it'll be like right next to them, but they can do a spin move that'll go out and put the soccer ball right in the goal. It'll make it spin like that. There's also spin moves, curveballs in softball and baseball, right? Now, the only reason those spin moves and those curveballs work is because you have air. If you're in the vacuum of space, curveballs don't work because you don't have the benefit of the air resistance being different when a ball is spinning. And so you couldn't use these types of moves in space. If you're trying to think of a colony in space or playing games in space, you'd have to think of everything so differently. You'd have to live in a dome or something. There's so many different things you have to consider. But I want to go back to some of these original questions I had posed. So two of the reasons why I think aerospace and engineering is, you know, one of the biggest passions I have is about space exploration, because scientists in every field, they are working to answer questions, right? That is the job of a scientist. But in my opinion, the scientists in the world of the aerospace industry work to answer two of the most profound questions that humans have ever asked. Where did we come from, right? Where did humans come from? And are we alone in the universe? These are really fun questions to think about. So where did we come from is a fun question, because there is, I want to share with you one of my favorite theories on this, and this is just a hypothesis. We don't actually know if this is true or not, but this is one of those questions that scientists are trying to understand. They're using experiments to test this hypothesis. And one of the ideas is something called panspermia. And it's this idea that life actually exists throughout the universe and is distributed planet to planet by asteroids, right? And the way that that would work is that, so there was this idea that life may have started on Mars, right? Mars today is kind of a dead planet, sort of a boring planet. There's not a lot going on there. It seems pretty dry. There's water and ice, but it's not like Earth, right? It's not super suitable for humans. But many, many years ago, Mars was very much like the Earth, with flowing water. They think it could have been way more habitable for life. And so there's this idea that many, many years ago, life may have started on Mars, and an asteroid hit Mars so fast and so hard that the life was distributed into the atmosphere and was going so, so fast that it went through the solar system, landed on Earth, and seeded life on Earth. So we may all be Martians, right? And this is one of those theories that scientists, or one of these hypotheses that scientists are testing with the rovers and the probes that they send to Mars. They're trying to dig underneath the surface and understand the history of Mars. Because to our knowledge, there is no life on Mars today and there never was in the past. But we don't know, right? What if we dig underneath the surface and start finding fossils? Right? That would be so wild. That would be so fascinating. And so that's one of the reasons why we're sending these probes and rovers to Mars. And actually, next week, today's Sunday, on Saturday, May 5th, NASA is sending their next big mission to Mars called the InSight Lander. So there will be a big launch at it's 4 a.m. Pacific time on Saturday morning, so really, really early. So if you want to watch a launch, it's actually launching from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. It's the very first interplanetary mission from the West Coast, which will be a fun one. And that one's studying the history of Mars and how it formed and how it became the type of planet that it is today. The second question: are we alone in the universe? This is a really interesting question because you have to define what it means to be life, and specifically what it means to be intelligent life, right? Because if you're searching for intelligent life in the universe, you first have to define what it means to be intelligent. And of course, humans have defined it in a way that makes us sound like the most intelligent species, and it's the ability to create and refine technology, right? That's our definition of what it means to be intelligent. So how do we search for intelligent life in the universe? And one of the mentalities that you can kind of think about to help answer that question is, if you were an alien on a planet far, far away, and your boss asked you to look at this planet called Earth and figure out if there's intelligent life on this planet, how would you figure it out? Because our cameras aren't good enough to see that far away. It's kind of like if you took a picture of your friend over on a hill a mile away and then tried to zoom in on her face, it would be blurry, right? Well, our cameras aren't that much better that we use to search for life in the universe. It's a bit blurry. And oftentimes the suns, the stars that these planets are orbiting around are so bright that it's overexposed. It's so hard to even see the planets themselves. So we have to think of a different way. We can't just use cameras. We can't zoom in and see if there's life on the surface. So the way that we do it is we search for signs of technology. Because a lot of our technology that we use today uses radio waves, right? They're invisible. You can't see them, but you can detect them. And the fun thing about radio waves is that they don't stop at the Earth's atmosphere. They keep going, spiraling through the universe at the speed of light, waiting for anyone who might be listening, right? It's our red flag to the universe that says, hey, we have intelligent life here. If you're listening to Earth, you can find these radio waves. And so that's how we search for intelligent life in the universe. We have these radio telescopes, which look like this. It's basically like a bowl, and it's our ear on the universe. And we just point this at different parts of the sky, and we listen. We are listening for radio waves, which means we're listening for intelligent life in the universe. And we haven't found anything yet. But I'm pretty confident, and I get this confidence because the people who are experts in this field say that they believe in their lifetime we will find signs of intelligent life, which is pretty exciting. And to say that we haven't found it yet doesn't really mean much because we've only been listening for like 40 or 50 years, right? Humans have been around for tens of thousands of years, and we've only been listening for life in the universe for 50 years. In the grand scheme of things, that's not a very long time. So there's a lot of sky to listen to. It takes a long time because we don't have telescopes that listen to every single part of the sky 24/7. Imagine if we were listening to one part of the sky, didn't hear anything, moved to a different part of the sky, and all of a sudden, planets in that part of the sky have intelligent life. And so we just weren't listening when they started to evolve. So I think it'll take a little bit of time to listen to every single part of the sky, but I'm confident that we'll be able to find intelligent life sometime soon. Let's see, we talked about that. But yeah, so that's the work that I do. That's why I'm excited about it. That's why I'm excited to bring Ada Lace to the world, because Ada Lace is very much the type of girl that works to solve all of these problems, that is fascinated by those questions, and is the type of aerospace engineer that would solve the problems in the Vomit Comet, that figure out how astronauts can live and work and work out in outer space, how fire propagates in outer space. And, you know, for me, when I was a kid, there weren't that many books that had lead female characters that were about science and adventure and all of that stuff. And so for me to bring Ada Lace to the world means a lot, because I want to make it feel very normal for girls to be interested in science. And to be clear, this book is for boys as well, right? It's very important for boys to read books with lead female characters that are really good at science and technology too, because representation is powerful. When you read about a character who's a girl who loves science and technology, it makes it feel a bit more normal for girls to be good at science and technology, not just for girls who read it, but for boys who read it as well. So that's the goal with the book. That's the story behind it. And I am happy to answer any questions that you may have. Yeah.
I thought NASA discontinued letting the public, I don't mean like when you have a science experiment, mm-hmm. riding on the Vomit Comet, because I wanted to do it. And when I called NASA, they said they don't let the public, unless you do a science experiment, do it.
Yeah, that's probably true. So NASA has their own program. That's like the Flight Opportunities Program that you can fly on it through. But Zero G Corporation is a private company that owns and operates their own Vomit Comet aircraft. So you can fly through them, but you'd have to buy a ticket. So, yeah. So there's still hope. They fly all over. They have planes like that fly out of Florida, out of Houston, out of Vegas. I think it's like a very fun thrill ride for people in Vegas. But yeah, they have them all over. Yeah.
First, I want to say thank you for coming. This is absolutely fascinating and exciting. And you're a wonderful presenter and ambassador for science. Does Ada Lace let her readers know how she got her name?
Ooh, no, that's a little bit of an Easter egg, but that's a good question. So for those that it's, you know, not obvious, Ada Lace is a nod to Ada Lovelace, who arguably, some people may not agree, but arguably is the very first computer programmer, not the first female computer programmer, the first computer programmer. And so there's a few other Easter eggs in the book about the nemesis is Milton Edison. Edison, not the greatest character in history, kind of a mean person. And so Edison, he's named after him. And then she names her robot George after the father of modern robotics, George Duval. And so when we have the opportunity, we do try to have them named after different people. We don't always make it obvious, though. Some of them, like Ada's, is a little bit of an Easter egg. Yeah.
How did you develop your characters and your stories?
Yeah, that's a good question. How did I develop my character? So I modeled Ada after the type of kid that I wished that I was more like when I was little. Because I liked math, but I wasn't a very confident student when I was growing up. I never considered myself one of the smart kids because I grew up in a town where there was a university, and the smart kids at my high school were the ones who had parents who were professors at the university who knew sort of what programs to put them in. They had all the right tutors, they applied to all the best schools, and they got into them. And I didn't feel like one of the smart kids. I was a little bit of a slow learner. And with Ada, I just feel like she's so confident at trying things. She doesn't care about, like, if she messes up, she works to solve a problem, even if it's hard. She doesn't get frustrated. She just keeps on going, 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 and has the confidence that eventually she'll be able to solve a problem. She has the mindset that if you work hard enough, you can make yourself one of the smart kids, which I think is something I learned later on in life, that, you know, even if you're a slow learner, there's no such thing as a smart kid and a not smart kid, right? It just takes a little bit of time to learn something. And if you put in the hard work, you'll be able to learn it. And so Ada herself is someone that I wished I was more like when I was a kid. Nina is based on one of my best friends growing up. She is just like a lovely person and very, so in the books, Ada is very smart analytically. She's very smart with science and technology. Her best friend, Nina, is really smart in a different way. She's really smart creatively, and she understands color really well and composition really well. And she just has that artistic mindset that is intelligent in a different way. And so it's fun throughout the stories to have those people work together to understand how people can be smart in different ways, and they can be very complementary. And so they solve different problems in each other's lives and help each other to work to solve those challenges. And yeah, and so I think that, and Ada's parents are not in science and technology. I wanted that to be a thing because my parents, I'm a first generation STEM person in my family and in my extended family for that matter. And so it was important to me to have this character love science and technology, not because her parents knew a lot about science and technology, that she sort of came to it on her own. So it's a little bit based on my family a bit, but other than that, we just wanted to find some fun characters and make it diverse and lead to some interesting like debacles that the kids get into. Yeah.
Thank you very much for your presentation. It's really great.
Yeah.
And the books, I'm looking forward to looking at them.
Thanks.
Could you tell us a little bit about your transition from A to B, that is from aerospace engineer to host on Fox?
Yeah, it's a very interesting transition, especially when I go and interview my friends who were studying aerospace engineering. And so I am very much on the media side now. So the way it actually logistically worked was I was graduating with my master's degree, and I got a call from a production studio that was like, we're looking for a person with a strong background in aerospace engineering. Would you like to be the host of a TV show about space? And I said yes, because I thought that sounded like an adventure. And they had found me because one thing that I did consistently throughout my engineering program, because I studied engineering for 8 years, and so throughout my education, I would always do a lot of outreach. I would go back to schools and I would talk to kids about the research that I was doing. I would do presentations. One very like nerdy thing that I did in undergrad was I created this presentation, not for students, but for the community of West Virginia, called Why NASA Matters. And I invited like my entire town to come to this event. It was like a town hall for why NASA is important. And the seats were mostly filled by my family and extended family that we forced to come. But it was this, you know, fun presentation of me talking about why I love NASA and why it's worth the money to invest. And there were videos of things like that online. So they had found me, they found my background, and then they saw me talking on camera and they were like, okay, this person has some social skills, which is maybe not the most common thing in the engineering world. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would like
skydive 4 times.
Whoa.
Whether you do it tandem or singly, if you do it high enough, you experience 30 seconds of weightlessness.
Oh, interesting. Okay, yeah. I mean, yeah, I guess you'll like reach escape velocity, or not escape velocity, terminal velocity, pretty quickly as well. But yeah, one of the episodes we did this past year, which I was not a fan of, was we were trying to demonstrate how a payload is delivered, safely delivered to a planet by a parachute, which is a common tactic we use on Mars. And so we proposed that I be the payload and the planet would be Earth. And so I skydived last year to demonstrate this concept, and it was the most terrifying thing I've done for my show yet. I did not enjoy it. Did not like it. Yeah.
I was a science and tech journalist for a few years, and I'm awesome. Very interested in getting back into the field. So, yeah. What would you say people could do in the media in order to better cover science?
Yes. Oh, my gosh. And that's such an important question, because I think there's a lot of sensationalism around science, where you'll see a headline that's like, researchers find that coffee makes your life better, that coffee is now good for you, chocolate is now good for you, and they misinterpret the conclusions of various research. And so I think some of the most important things that we can do in the journalism community, because I worked as a space journalist for a little while as well, but having a very clear line of communication with the scientists that are studying whatever you're covering is really important. Having that trust of scientists, because what scientists don't like is when their research is covered and then they get that sensationalist headline where they misconstrue the results of their research, because their community will be like, I saw that the New York Times cited your research and said that you said that chocolate is now good for you. And they're like, no, that's not what my research said. They misconstrued the conclusions. They sensationalized it. It was clickbaity and everything. So scientists sometimes have this reservation of even talking to journalists, which is not a good thing, right? Because you want to be able to share science with the world. And when a scientist doesn't want to talk to the media, that can be a very bad thing. So having a good relationship with scientists, having a clear line of communication, and we could go into this because I have a lot of friends in the world of journalism where there's a question of like, do you allow them to read over your work before you publish it? Because that's not standard protocol for journalism, right? You don't generally let your sources read your work before you publish it. That's just not the way that things work. But with science, is it different? Do you make an exception so that it's accurate and, you know, they fact check it and everything? There's a lot of questions that I think people in that world are asking today that are really interesting.
Why did you decide to make Elliot obsessed with pirates?
So Elliot is Ada's little brother, who is a character. And so in the very first book, he is obsessed with pirates. You'll find that in other books, he's obsessed with other things. I think he's just the type of person that really dives into something and just loves it 130% for that time in his life, and then quickly moves on to something else. It's kind of like if you've ever watched a movie over and over and over and over and over and over again, and you watch it like 20 times, you never get sick of it. That's kind of like the type of person that Elliot is. And we just picked pirates for the first one because we thought it was fun.
I've got a question.
Yeah.
Is Pluto a planet or not? I'm a teacher.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
The word was a few years ago, it's no longer a planet because it orbits
planet.
In a different direction.
Yeah.
So do scientists still consider it a planet?
No, they don't. I mean, and it's such a funny argument in the scientific world, because it is still controversial. And as you can imagine, there was this mission called New Horizons that was the first mission to Pluto. And that mission launched when we still thought Pluto, or we still considered Pluto, a planet. And then this conversation happened, and we're like, you know what, let's reclassify it as something called a dwarf planet. And then it comes to Pluto, and it shows how dynamic and beautiful Pluto is. It sent us back the very first clear images of Pluto that had, I don't know if you remember it, but it had like the shape of a heart kind of on the surface. And so people just fell in love with Pluto. And we found that it has like a very thin atmosphere. And I think it has even like some kind of like moons around it, very small moons around. And so there's these things that we found that were like, well, it feels so much like a planet. But the problem is, if we consider Pluto a planet, there are hundreds, maybe thousands of other asteroid-type rocks orbiting our sun that we should also consider planets. So then the question is, do we allow everything to be a planet? And or do we become very, very specific and only consider the eight planets that we know of today to be planets because they are large enough to have made their bodies like round, they've cleared their orbit, which is a very interesting definition of what a planet is today. You have to make sure that the orbit that you're in around the sun, you're large enough that you've either run into things or things have like moved out of your way. You have to clear your orbit around the sun. And so, yeah, I think it's an interesting question. It's just a classification. It's just a word. It's funny how scientists care so much. But if you're that person from New Horizons that spent your life's work on this mission to Pluto, it feels like a personal attack in some ways when people are like, it's no longer considered a planet. And you're just like, we just sent a mission there, and are you saying that my mission's less important now? And it's like, no, that's not really what it is. But people, it's a heated argument. Like, people are still really upset about it.
So do we officially have eight planets?
Yeah, I mean, officially in science books have now been rewritten. The general scientific community agrees that it should be considered a dwarf planet. But it is funny how scientists, you know, scientists are humans. They still have an emotional attachment to the work that they do in many ways. Because sometimes we think of these scientists as these like people and a white tower, and they're just like working in isolation and they're analytical and just very objective. And no, that's not how it works. Scientists still have human emotions. And so we get these like very interesting arguments in the community where people get mad. People get really, really mad when you have that discussion. So for me, I'm just like, I don't care. Like, whatever you want, but like, let's all agree on one thing. that's the important part, that we all agree on a certain set of facts. But yeah, it's interesting.
Thank you. I have a big question. Mm-hmm. This is something, you know, I'm an older person and I've observed a lot of history, and I'm also have a PhD in psychology, research psychology, so I'm basically a scientist at heart.
Yeah.
One thing I've seen happen that concerns me very much is this relationship between the military and science, so that scientific discoveries are often then used to create more sophisticated weapons, to the point where we're left with this problem of nuclear bombs and really a threat to our species. Do you think it's too late for women being involved in the sciences to maybe slow that down? Because I'm very concerned about the weaponization of space. And when you hear the title Star Wars and what that franchise means to so many boys and men, that linkage between war and space, I think is very much part of a fantasy life of a lot of young people.
Yeah.
This really, really concerns me that weapons will then be taken into space and war will go from our planet to the point where I think it's maybe irreversible.
Yeah, man, a lot to unpack there. So one, I'll kind of go through my thought process as you were talking. One, I think science and technology itself is very neutral. It's sort of what humans do with it that can be seen as either evil or helpful or neutral as well. And so there's this concern that maybe science and technology is moving too fast, and regulation and safety protocol and all of these things won't be able to catch up, because historically with bureaucracy, those things can take a long time, right? So later in my master's, I got a second master's in something called science and technology policy, which was basically questioning how we regulate technology, how we fund technology, how we make technology safe. What is the role of government? What's the role of regulations for things like different, something like a chemical weapon, for example, should scientists even research something like that? So that A, we better understand how they work, which seems like a good thing, but even the act of researching, is that a negative thing? Is that a dangerous thing? Because again, humans are not objective all the time. They have their own incentives. They have their own, you know, needs and desires, and they need to make money, and all of these factors that factor into how a researcher who's studying something so dangerous, what might they do with that knowledge? And I think you talked a lot about how women factor into this, because historically these decisions of how to keep things safe throughout our lives have been made by men. And research has showed that when you bring people with diverse backgrounds to the table, you get better ideas that bubble up to the top, because you have different ideas from different angles. People think about things differently, and women factor into that because we have very different experiences than men do generally. And so when you have more people from diverse backgrounds making the decisions of how to keep science and technology safe, how to make these regulations appropriate so that we don't stifle innovation and technology development, but at the same time, we're keeping a handle of how it's progressing so that it's not progressing too quickly. Bringing not just women, but like just diverse people to the table to make those decisions is really important. And it's in our best interest to be doing so. And so, you know, we're not there yet, clearly. But I think that should be an incentive for anyone who wants to make science and technology safe, is to bring women to the table. And then weaponizing space, we have the Outer Space Treaty, which is this international treaty that something like, I forget the number, it's like 122 countries have signed and ratified or something along those lines. And so it's most of the world, most of the developed world, I guess. But we have signed this treaty and agreed on the rules of conduct. And one of those is that no weapons can be in space. And so we do have a rule that prevents like Star Wars from happening, but nobody has broken that rule yet. So we don't know what the repercussions are. What happens if somebody does break that rule? And right now we have, you know, over 100 countries that would be ready to punish you. So hopefully that's a deterrent. We're working on a deterrent type of mindset. But yeah, there is the question of what if somebody breaks that rule, what happens? So I think making sure that we have diverse people at the table making these decisions is certainly a helpful way to mitigate problems that could arise. But yeah, we do have rules in place that hopefully prevent that. And so I'm not too worried about that just yet, but I don't know. Well, hopefully with, I think that the current administration had said something along the lines of like, building a military in space, and everybody in the space community was like, whoa, that's not legal. You probably haven't read the Outer Space Treaty. And so someone in our current administration had sort of said something along the lines that would be breaking the Outer Space Treaty and made the entire aerospace community very nervous for a quick second. But I think like many things, it was a tweet and then forgotten about. But yeah, something to keep an eye on. Yeah.
Hi. I'm sorry, I just walked in. I was on a camping trip with my daughter, so I just got here. So I don't know what you said before, but I'm just interested. She's almost 7 years old. She's really interested in science, really interested in sports, and just like, but so I want to keep encouraging that, and I'm going to buy the books that you're writing so I can do that. Awesome. But I just wanted to know, you know, at this point, I don't think she sees that there's like any reason why she shouldn't want to be a scientist, you know, but at a certain point she might come up against that. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to know like what advice you have. I mean, one of them, I guess part of it is reading books like this, but like from your personal experience or just otherwise, is there any advice you have for that?
So generally my advice when parents ask that is finding lots of different female personalities that are doing many different types of science and just putting them in front of her. And so the best resource that I usually recommend is YouTube. And I have a Rolodex of women scientists on YouTube who are funny and quirky and dorky and like charismatic and elegant, and they span the personality spectrum, and they're of different like ethnic backgrounds, and they have their own voice. And so I usually recommend, and I can give you a list before you leave, yeah, of women on YouTube that is just like, they make science fun on YouTube, and they get engaged with their personalities and kind of have this accidental learning effect where you're just like, you're watching a YouTube channel and oh, they're talking about physics and the science of light and all of this stuff, and you don't realize that you're learning along the way because you're just, you're watching this weekly YouTube series of this girl who's funny and makes funny jokes and is amazing. So I usually have those. There's also toys that I like. Goldieblox is a really good one. Ruminate, it's like these types of toys where scientists want to reinvent the pink aisle, and they have looked at studies of how little boys and little girls play differently, usually in respect to Legos. Legos inherently, boys have been found to like build tall buildings and then tear it down and then build something else and then tear it down and build something. And women, little girls, we generally build something slowly, add something over here, add something over here, and just build onto it slowly and like to preserve things and build up their own world. And so there's this concept that obviously doesn't always apply, but in general, many little girls play differently. And so these new toys are based on that research, or based on that knowledge. And so there's a lot of cool toys out there that I can also recommend. But yeah, in books like these, just making it totally normal. I also have an internal conflict of how much I talk about science being a male-dominated field. Because for me, I didn't realize that until I got to college. Because I was very lucky. I went to a high school and a university town where there was an equal number of girls and boys that love science and tech. And the people who led our robotics team were women. And like all of that was seemed so normal. And then I got to college, and in a 50-person class, there were two women. And I was like, where did everybody go? I'm like, oh, they went to the Ivy League schools. And so I was the only one that went to my state school in West Virginia, and that's when I learned that, okay, this is going to be an adjustment. No, I don't. I mean, and everybody's going to be different, because if I learned it earlier, would that have deterred me from doing something that I absolutely love? Because when you're choosing engineering as a high school senior, that's already a scary thing to do. You hear of engineering and you're like, oh, that's a hard major. Right? There's easy majors and hard majors. And in your head, you're like, that's a hard major. And you don't need one other thing to maybe be like, well, maybe I'll just take multiple disciplinary studies and then figure it out later. I'll just like figure it out later. And then you just never do it. And so for me, with my, and everybody has a different theory on this, but for me and my TV show, we make sure we put diverse people in front of the camera, even though the aerospace industry is not diverse. We paint this picture of a very diverse, inclusive world, and we don't often talk, I mean, there are some exceptions, but we don't often talk about it being a male-dominated field and not having, you know, a lot of minorities, people of color, like all of that. We generally just paint this rosy picture, because sometimes I think that could also be helpful. You don't always want to bash little like mine saying, you're going to enter this world of a male-dominated field and you better be ready. Right? I'm not sure that that's the right mentality. Because for me, it was fine. I was lucky because I had a lot of support. The professors I had were super wonderful. The guys in my program were always wonderful. So I had a very helpful, inclusive experience, even though I was just happened to be one of the only women in the room. Yeah. Cool. Thank you.
Will you be book signing outside in the courtyard?
Sure. Yeah.
So right around the corner there, there'll be book signing in the courtyard.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.